Good morning and welcome to the podcast of the First Universalist Unitarian Church of Wausau. My name is Brian Mason and I serve this church as minister, and I am joined this morning by Donica Kozlovich, Margaret Jurs, and Julie Trombley. Since COVID-19 has forced all of us to practice physical distancing and learn new ways to church, I've been delighted to work with these three witty, adaptable, and creative people. I speak for all of us when I say that we have enjoyed connecting with many of you online, but please let us know how we're doing and offer suggestions if you see areas where we can improve. Today is Palm Sunday in the Christian liturgical calendar, a day that celebrates humility, justice, and righteousness, and a day that Democrats like to remind Republicans that Jesus did not ride a elephant into Jerusalem, but a donkey. But it is bittersweet, because if everything was going as planned, we'd be settling in for a service led by this church's high school youth. And if those high school's youth are listening, and I hope they are, I want them to know that your minister and staff miss your energy and presence and look forward to the day you're able to offer the great people of this church a good word, a bit of challenge, and a lot of hope. For those of you who regularly attend services, you know that our church is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. And in honor of that special occasion, I've been re-preaching sermons by this church's former ministers. And so far, we have heard from John Robinson first, and then Brainerd Gibbons, and of course, Glenda Walker. But this morning, I thought that I would throw just a bit of a curveball since baseball season is tentatively canceled, and I would re-preach the very first sermon I offered to this congregation 3 years ago when I was then a candidate for this pulpit. And if you listen closely, you will hear just how vital I believe the presence and participation of children and young adults are to any church. I'll go so far as to say that I might not be a Unitarian Universalist without experiencing the coming-of-age service led by the high school youth at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis back in 2009. I owe those high schoolers in particular and the guiding wisdom of the religious educators a debt of gratitude that I can repay only with the faithfulness with which I carry out my calling as a minister. And not just any minister, but the minister to this wonderful church way up here in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin, a place where I have made many friends and chosen to set down roots and make a life with my family. Next Sunday is Easter, and the staff and I are planning a few special things, so keep an eye out for those announcements in the usual places. But dear friends, I invite you now to come into this circle of caring. Come into this community of gentleness, justice, and love. Call and you will be refreshed. Let the healing power of this people inspire you. Let loving kindness and joy pass through you. Let hope infuse you and peace be the law of your heart. In this human circle, caring is calling. And every single one of you have been called. So come into this circle of caring and let us worship together. And now, if you will, join me wherever you are in our unison chalice lighting. We light this chalice for the light of truth, the warmth of love, and the fire of commitment. We light this symbol of our faith as we gather together.
Thank you. Today's story is based on a story titled Sophie and the Red Marker, which was told by the Unitarian Universalist minister, Alison Palm. It's being adapted and shared with her permission. There once was a kid named Sophie who loved going to church every Sunday with her family. The people there were all super fun, and she loved singing along to the hymns, and she was always excited to hear the story for all ages. Then one day, her dad told her they couldn't go to church for a while. There was a nasty sickness going around that was like the flu but worse, and everyone needed to stay home to keep each other safe. That meant no school, no playgrounds, and worst of all, no church. Luckily, her dad told her, they could go to church on the computer and still sing along with the hymns and hear the story each week. But Sophie was sad. Church on the computer was okay, but it just wasn't the same as going to the building, giving hugs, and getting to actually go to the front of the sanctuary to hear the story. Sophie told her dad that she was feeling sad about not going to church. I miss actually being there, said Sophie. Maybe you could draw a picture of the church, her dad suggested. Then you could put it somewhere in the house, and whenever you miss church, you could go visit your picture. Sophie liked that idea. So she pulled out some markers and a sheet of paper and started to draw. First, she drew the sanctuary with the stained glass art at the front. Next, she drew her classroom. Finally, she drew the beautiful sunny atrium where the kids ate tasty muffins and played chess while the adults drank coffee at the end of the service. She held up her drawing and thought she had done a pretty good job of drawing the church. But when she looked at the picture, she didn't get any of the warm, fuzzy feelings that she usually felt at church. Sophie brought the picture over to her dad and said, I did what you asked, and I drew a picture of the church, but looking at it doesn't make me feel like church. Said her dad. Well, how does church make you feel? Sophie thought about that for a moment. I feel happy when I'm at church, and really hopeful, like anything is possible. What else? Asked her dad. I feel strong. Like even when I'm sad, if I'm at church, I know I will get through it. And I feel lots of love. The people at church really care about me. Maybe you should try drawing all of that instead of the building, Sophie's dad suggested. Sophie liked that idea, and she ran off to get a new sheet of paper and her markers to start again. This time, she thought about how she felt at church as she drew. She started by drawing a chalice, because the chalice made her feel at home at church. She liked watching Brian light the chalice every week and hearing everyone say the chalice lighting words together. In her class, she got to take a turn lighting the chalice, and that made her feel special. Then she drew some music notes, because singing at church always made her feel so happy. She started humming her favorite hymn while she drew. Next, she drew a flower, because flowers made her feel hopeful, like springtime. And they reminded her of the flower communion they did at church each year. That was one of her favorite services. Then she decided to draw a whole bunch of people, because it was the other people at church who made her feel strong. She knew they were always there for her, even if she couldn't give them hugs right now. Then she remembered the story from the first week she and her dad listened to on their computer as they listened to church, and she drew light, almost invisible strings between all of the people. Finally, she drew a big heart to remind her of all the love she felt at church and all the love she had for her church. Sophie held up the drawing, and this time she felt like she'd gotten it right. This made her feel like church. Sophie got some tape and put her drawing in the corner of her bedroom. Over the next few weeks, whenever she was feeling sad or lonely or missing her friends or teachers at church, she went to that corner and sat with her church drawing. Sometimes she just sat and felt her feelings. Sometimes she sang her favorite hymn while she was there. Sometimes she brought her markers and added something new to the drawing. It wasn't the same as actually being at church, but it reminded Sophie of how she felt when she was at church. When she went and sat with her drawing, she felt happier, more hopeful, stronger, and held in love. She felt connected to her church community even when they were apart. Did you find yourself in this story? I wonder how church makes you feel. What might you include in your drawing of church? Maybe this week you'd like to make a drawing like that and share it in our private Facebook group or hang it somewhere in your house.
I'd like to invite everyone into a time of prayer and meditation. And as you prepare yourself, I have a couple of community announcements to share with everyone. The first is that Nan Cedar's mom, Priscilla, died on Thursday. And the second is that Marguerite Donnelly is home recovering from a surgery. So I ask that you lift up those two and their families and their loved ones and everyone that's caring for them and about them. Set aside a special place in your heart for them in the days and weeks to come. And wherever you are on a run, if you're sitting at home, center yourself in the way that you can. But start by taking a breath. Try and clear your mind of those distractions. And let us journey into meditation together with these words. Most holy life, for even though our hearts know praise and thanks, our living is in distress. We watch as a virus claims the lives of thousands. We offer all the compassion we can muster towards those we wish we could reach out and touch, all those whose days are dominated by illness and suffering. We look within ourselves and see that sorrow is seeping into those inner places. So much of what we're experiencing is beyond our control. Help us to know what is ours to do in these uncertain times. Let us search for ways to let radiance shine. Let us live each day with steadfast love and be bearers of unstoppable compassion. And now call into your minds all those millions around the world in pain and need. And call into your minds all those whose strength fails because of misery. And call into your minds all the joys and sorrows of your own lives. And let us meditate in silence together now. Amen.
Today's reading comes from the book of Luke, chapter 12, verses 22 to 34. Jesus said to his disciples, "Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse nor barn, and yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And can any of your worrying add a single hour to your span of life? If then you are not able to do so small a thing as that, why do you worry about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown in the oven, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And do not keep striving for what you are to eat and what you are to drink, and do not keep worrying. For it is the nations of the world that strive after these things, and God knows that you need them. Instead, strive for God's kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well. Do not be afraid, little flock, for it is God's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give alms. Make purses for yourselves that do not wear out. An unfailing treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
I was raised in the Assemblies of God Church, a vibrant, charismatic Christian tradition that continues to inform my faith to this day. And while I may not practice or adhere to some of its religious or social convictions, my UU Christian faith does cling to my spiritual beginnings, emphasis on personal testimony of belief. Now, there are many traditions that share an emphasis on the importance of personal testimony. Mormons and Quakers, Muslims and Jews, and dozens more testify to the power of hearing and sharing personal stories of faith. You see, when we share our personal religious stories with one another, we form the foundation of our spiritual community, a place where people are made to feel whole, accepted, and loved. This morning, I will share with you my own Unitarian Universalist testimony, but more than that, I wish to share with you a love story. I haven't always been a minister, I'll have you know. Prior to answering a call to the ministry, as us ministers like to say, I worked for a large telecommunications company. I started out in an entry-level sales position, and after a while, I managed to move up the company ladder. An upward mobility provided more money, perks, and freedom. Around this time, I was young, impulsive, and relatively well off for an early 20-something, so I did what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. I moved across the country whenever I felt like it, from my hometown of Farmington, Missouri, to Chicago, then to Boulder, Colorado, and later to St. Louis. I golfed, I hiked, and I skied, and I did all three of those things often. And rarely, if ever, did I cook my own food. I traveled Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana fly fishing. I traveled throughout New England and anywhere else that I wanted to go, and all the while, I managed to grow and diversify my portfolio. I was, as the saying goes, fit as a fiddle, without hardly a care in the world. And it was during this time of prosperity that I, along with several friends, took a trip to St. Simon's Island, Georgia. My plan, as it is with every vacation I have ever taken, is to do absolutely nothing aside from indulge in the island's golf courses, beaches, and restaurants. And I vowed long before I ever took this vacation that if I was to be forced to cook, I would cook only grilled meats and I would imbibe only cold, fizzy beverages. But I am an introvert, so it takes only a day or two for me to reach maximum overload. And so I borrowed one of my friend's cars to find some much-needed peace and quiet. But really, I just wanted to sneak a cigarette or two without my friends learning that after celebrating with me that I had finally quit smoking cigarettes, that I was still smoking them in secret. So I drove aimlessly around this island searching for a top secret hiding place, searching from one edge of the island, and upon noticing a graveyard, determined that a graveyard would in fact be the best place to sneak a cigarette. Because nothing says fresh air quite like smoking cigarettes in a graveyard. And so I wandered the cemetery grounds shaded under ancient oak trees covered in Spanish moss. The hiss of wildlife was all around me, and it was so powerful. I could feel that buzz deep in my chest. And way off on the edge of the graveyard stood a quaint church. And I am a naturally curious man, and so I had to see if the door was unlocked. And as I walked into the sanctuary, I noticed a stoic-looking woman. I'd estimate somewhere between 60 and 70 years old. And just as I appeared in that sanctuary, this woman turned and she said in a southern drawl, "Why don't you come on in and sit down and cool off? It's never by an accident that a man finds himself on a cool place on a hot day." And so I did. She was a retired professor, and she asked me if I was interested in hearing the story of the church. And she promised that it would take just about 15 minutes of my time. And so I glanced down at my watch, and I pre-regretted my answer, and I said, "Okay, why not?" So long ago, the Civil War had devastated this region. The church building and the congregants were not immune, and the church was nearly destroyed. The surviving families were forced to worship in their homes where the minister would visit often to give them communion or baptize newborns. But by the end of the 19th century, members of this community had pooled their resources, harvesting what they could of the old building, and they set out to build a brand new church, a new home for their sacred community. Now just imagine that these are completely everyday people. They're builders and craftsmen and clergymen, and they would meet after work and on weekends to build this church. They sacrificed their time and money to bring this church back into the world. Legend has it that the families would eat and sing as they built this church together, and they'd celebrate births and marriages, and they'd mourn the death of friends and loved ones, laying them to rest under the very same oak trees that shade the grounds today. The professor explained to me that architecturally, the church is essentially an upside-down boat. Most of the craftsmen were shipbuilders, and so they built what they knew how, pointing a ship's keel toward the sky, and they built the sanctuary as if it were the bottommost deck. Those early congregants gave all of their free time to build this church so they'd have a common place to gather and worship. But more than anything else, the professor said, those early members gathered to dream the world anew, to strive for a new reality, one of safety, inclusion, and belonging. I'm embarrassed to admit this, but never until that moment had I considered the miracle of selflessness and the utter tragedy of human suffering. I had never felt the thrum of nature in my chest or considered the lilies and the ravens. I had never thought hard about the power of community coming together to share a common hope, a hope to dream the world otherwise. To dream up a world where people can be born and live and die knowing that their life mattered, that their life had grandeur and meaning. What I'm trying to tell you is that these people shared a sacred dream called community. And then finally, this history lesson was over. But the professor did sucker me into buying the church's $20 cookbook before I left. And I still have that cookbook to this day. And as I walked out of the cool church back into the hot day, I knew in that moment that my life would never be the same. It couldn't remain the same. And I can't really say what it is that told me this. It might have been intuition of some kind, but I tend to think God sparked in me a call to the ministry. But I had just the tiniest problem. You see, I hadn't been to church in a while, and so I had to set out to find a church. When I say I hadn't been to church in a while, what I mean is like years. And what I mean by years, I mean like years and years. By that time in my life, I had formed a good number of social and political convictions that I refused to compromise. No theology, creed, or force of nature would bend my belief that all people are born with inherent value regardless of their skin color, their sexual orientation, zip code, clothes style, language, level of education, or religion. I knew that I couldn't be a part of a church that ran counter to what I believe are fundamental truths. And with all of this in mind, I set out to find a church. And in every church I visited, I always was welcomed and fed. I was inspired and challenged and kissed and hugged. But I always left wanting something more. By this point in my life, I had decided to go back to college, and I had developed a close friendship with a professor of mine who just so happens to be a Catholic nun. I told her that I was having trouble finding a church that spoke to my heart. And so she asked me, she said, "Brian, have you ever heard of Unitarian Universalism?" Which, of course, I hadn't. What she suggested was that I check the church out because she felt confident that there in those UU churches, I would be certain to find some allies. But she assured me that if Unitarian Universalism doesn't work out for me, she said I could always try my hand at being a nun. And so finally, early one summer, I walked into the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis, and I had no idea that it was the coming-of-age service that day. 10 or so young adults had embarked on a spiritual, emotional, and intellectual journey into the mystery of being. They studied world religions, traveled to holy sites, had conversations about life and love and relationships and romance. And after the students were introduced, they spoke their minds with such boldness. Some of them said they were atheists, others agnostics, others were Christians, others Buddhists, others were utterly bewildered by religion at all. But what every single one of them shared was a hope and love for their church community that supported and inspired them to become who they dreamed to be. And they dreamed to be equestrian scientists and journalists, job seekers, writers, nurses, and dreamers. It was a celebration of human possibility and an absolute affirmation of life. And I knew, sitting in those pews, that I had found a home, my very own sacred community. However, there was one last transition I still had to make. I decided that I would have to resign my good job. And so after nearly 6 years working my way into a position and a salary many people work a lifetime to achieve with vacation days, bonuses, investment matching, perks, and possibilities for advancement, and going against the cautioning of every single member of my family and friends who literally begged me to keep my cushy job and let me belong to country clubs and afford an American Express charge card, I quit. I left my high-paying, white-collar job and went to work at a neighborhood Olive Garden, because nothing caps off a mystical experience quite like never-ending soup, salad, and breadsticks. Now, my friends had worried that I was suffering from a nervous breakdown, and they would ask me at Christmas and Thanksgiving, and they would even write little notes in my birthday cards if I was sure that I wasn't able to get my job back once waiting tables in college didn't work out. And I would always smile, and I would say, "It's fine, don't worry," because I knew deep down that there was nothing else I'd rather be doing. Because little did they know, and little did I know at the time, that I would fall in love while waiting tables at the Maplewood Olive Garden. In fact, I would have my rehearsal dinner in the back of that Olive Garden. I don't recommend that, by the way. And I would find out I was going to be a father on my way to a shift at that same Olive Garden. It's strange how things end up in the long run. I'd end up working that sufferable job for nearly 5 years, right up until the summer before I entered seminary, and a year into my marriage, and 10 months into my daughter's life. And it was around this time that my wife and I started spending a lot of time in hospitals. Our daughter, we'd soon find out, was born with a rare genetic condition that resulted in incurable blindness. Our storybook romance changed in an instant. We became medical curiosities, fodder for genetic researchers, visited daily in our home by therapists, social workers, and a diverse array of staff people from various agencies. Regardless of how wonderful, warm, and caring the doctors, nurses, and therapists were, I felt so scared and alone, as if I'd been cast out to sea. And so I withdrew from the world. I left home only when I had to. Everywhere I went, I felt like people wanted me to explain my child's disability and talk about how she sees and interacts with the world. My wife and I isolated ourselves, rarely going to our beloved UU church. It was just too much for us then. It was easier to be home where nobody would ask us any questions. We'd even kept her eye alignment surgery a secret from everyone but our parents and closest friends. And so one evening after Ellie's surgery, I found myself watching a sunset as my wife sang Ellie to bed. I really don't know or remember what she was singing. All I could hear was her soft voice, which was enough for me. Because it's always those subtle, unexpected things of life that I most revel in. And then the phone rang. On the other end was the pastoral care minister from Elliott Unitarian Chapel. He had overheard a conversation about Ellie's surgery one day in church. And so he called me that night because he told me he was heartbroken. Not for anything I'd personally done, but because I hadn't let anyone in the church know that a child of the congregation, a child born and dedicated there, was having surgery. He was sad because he knew I didn't have to be alone. I didn't know what to say, and so I decided I should just apologize for not regularly attending church. And like a gentleman, he accepted my apology, but he wasn't really interested in that. Instead, he told me something that I needed to hear. And he said this: "No matter what you're going through, no matter how hard things get, always know that as long as there is a place in your heart that calls this church home, then trust that that's enough. But know that you are loved, Brian. And then he hung up. Little did I know that I lived in the heart of a loving community. I used to spend a lot of time in hospitals and waiting rooms for another reason, too. Part of a Unitarian minister's formation is called clinical pastoral education. All of us are required to study for a time in hospitals, nursing homes, or hospices. And while we're there, our spiritual, emotional, and intrapersonal maturity are evaluated. Every day we live side by side with other aspiring ministers from every creed and denomination. But most of the time we're with patients and their families in routine and extraordinary situations. That first summer working as a hospital chaplain awakened me to the realities of human fragility, the miracle of modern medicine, and the utter brutality of violence. More times than I can count, I sat as physicians told families that their loved ones wouldn't or didn't survive some malady or accident. And just days before the end of my coursework, I responded to a page from the emergency room, and it said this. It said that there's a 20-something male with a gunshot wound to his neck and his hands. And he's down in the emergency room, and they've started CPR. And so I got up from my desk, and I descended from my office on the 15th floor. And as I went down, I prayed for the best, but prepared for the worst. When I arrived, the man was on a bed in the middle of the emergency room. Every piece of modern trauma medicine was summoned to save this young man's life. But his injuries were too much. It wasn't but a moment later that a secretary, scared and shaken by the scene, told me that the man's family was in the waiting room, and dozens of them. I saw terror in their faces and sorrow in their eyes. And so I went to them and I held their hands and I prayed with them before I called the physician in who told them the tragic news. The young man's girlfriend fainted right in front of me. His sister passed out and others ran out in tears screaming. The man's mother and grandmother sat with tears streaming down their faces as the world around them shook from the shattering of a lifetime of hopes and dreams and memories. Police told me that they'd allow only two people to see this young man's body. So the boy's mother and grandmother and I went to his bedside together. The nurses had prepared his body for viewing. Before we got there, they had cleaned the blood from his face and laid his arms across his chest. And then I pulled down the sheet and we stood there. He was 20 years old. A few weeks before that moment, he had proposed to his high school sweetheart and he had gotten a job working at Home Depot. He had just bought a car, his mom told me, and he was decorating a room in his apartment. After his mother showed me pictures on her phone and told me about his bravery and talents, she stood to leave. And there in the room with her mother and son, she turned to me and she said, "Pastor, thank you for praying for my boy. Thank you for being here with us. He is in heaven. And an angel now." And so I was ordained in an emergency room by a suffering mother, and then she sealed it with an embrace and a kiss on my cheek. But her gratitude was too tender a gift for me. It broke me open emotionally. And so I did the only thing I could think of and sought guidance from a spiritual director, a rough talking 80-year-old nun. I explained to her, I said that accepting that mother's gratitude is more than I can take. I just don't understand it. All I can think about is the trauma and the tragedy, and I don't even know if I believe in heaven at all. I told her that I felt inadequate and like a phony. And the good nun listened to me, and she said, "I think it's unwise to resist people's thanksgiving." She didn't offer it because it's owed. You got it because she gave you a gift. My advice is, bottle it up and share it with the world, because all of us could stand to learn a bit more about gratitude. And besides, Brian, nobody really cares about heaven. I've always thought it sounded like an eternity at a boring relative's house. And just as I was leaving, she asked me, "Can you think of a better heaven than to live on in the hearts of people who love you? Because I can't." And here we are, and there you are, friends, home, physically isolated, but joined together under the sacred banner of this great church. None of you are the same. You're all so unique and special and odd in your own ways. I want you to know in your heart that whether you are a first-time visitor, a semi-regular attender, or a thoroughgoing tithe-giving regular, whether you are a secret cigarette smoker, a late bloomer, second chancer, a mystic, rationalist, or saint, whether you feel the thrum of the earth in your chest, or you pray to God or dream of heaven, whether you are sick or well, young or old, rich or poor, as long as there is a place in your heart that dreams the world otherwise and calls this community home, for all that you are, for all that you've ever been, and for all that you remain to become, I thank you. Amen. Friends, wherever you are, take the hand of someone nearby, if you're lucky to be sitting next to someone. Or if you're out on a run, put your hand to your chest. May the truth that sets us free, and the hope that never dies, and the love that casts out fear lead us forward together until the day spring breaks and all shadows flee away.